Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, we are back. As you can probably guess, the number is 888-914-9149. I have room for you now, but I can't guarantee you'll be there in another 5 minutes because the phone lines tend to really fill up. So call now, 888-914-9149. Let's get over to Colby now in St. Cloud, Minnesota. Good morning, Colby.
Hello, Patrick.
Hi.
I have a question for you. So I'm a cradle Catholic, and I'm currently dating a woman who grew up Protestant, and she's recently become interested in the Catholic faith and has a lot of questions. However, I can't really answer them to the best of my abilities, so I'm coming to you, and she has your app so she can listen to it. So her question is, why can't women become priests?
Great question, and it comes up a lot. Let me read to you a brief kind of explanation that was given by Pope John Paul II. He issued an apostolic letter. This is going back to, when was this? This was, 1994 is when he issued this. So just about 30 years ago now. And he answered this question with this apostolic letter. So how about if I just read that? It's not very long. And then I can elaborate on a few points. How does that sound?
Sure, sounds good.
Okay, yeah, because you know, after all, he was the Pope, so his teaching carries a lot of weight here. So he says, priestly ordination, which hands on the office entrusted by Christ to his apostles of teaching, sanctifying, and governing the faithful, has in the Catholic Church from the beginning always been reserved to men alone. This tradition has also been faithfully maintained by the Oriental churches. He's referring there to the Eastern churches, such as the Eastern Orthodox churches. When the question of the ordination of women arose in the Anglican Communion, Pope Paul VI, out of fidelity to his office of safeguarding the apostolic tradition, and also with a view to removing a new obstacle placed in the way of Christian unity, reminded Anglicans of the position of the Catholic Church, quote, "She holds that it is not admissible to ordain women to the priesthood for very fundamental reasons. These reasons include the example recorded in the sacred scriptures of Christ choosing his apostles only from among men, the constant practice of the church, which has imitated Christ in choosing only men, and her living teaching authority, which has consistently held that the exclusion of women from the priesthood is in accordance with God's plan for his church." So that part right there is him quoting Pope Paul VI. And the reason that Pope Paul VI said this to the Anglicans is because they were, back in the 1970s, beginning to ordain women. So this was an obstacle to eventual reunion with the Catholic Church, and Pope Paul VI pointed that out. So John Paul II continues, "But since the question had also become the subject of debate among theologians and in certain Catholic circles, Paul VI directed the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith to set forth and expound the teaching of the Church on this matter. This was done through the declaration Inter Insigniores, which the Supreme Pontiff approved and ordered to be published. The declaration recalls and explains the fundamental reasons for this teaching, reasons expounded by Pope Paul VI, and concludes that the Church does not consider herself authorized to admit women to priestly ordination. To these fundamental reasons, the document adds other theological reasons which illustrate the appropriateness of the divine provision," referring there to holy orders for men only. "It also shows clearly that Christ's way of acting did not proceed from sociological or cultural motives peculiar to his time. As Paul VI later explained, the real reason is that in giving the Church her fundamental constitution, her theological anthropology, thereafter always followed by the Church's tradition, Christ established things in this way." Now, I'd like to elaborate on what he's saying there, because this is rather technical language, and it may not be immediately clear what he's saying. What he's saying here is that, over against those who claim otherwise, Jesus was not a hostage to the culture and the mores of his time. He was not bound. Some people say that, well, Jesus didn't ordain women because that was unheard of and unthinkable in a patriarchal society. That's not true. Jesus didn't ordain women because it would have been, you know, contrary to the customs and the religion and all that. That's not true. And one way to prove that that's not true is to see Jesus in the Gospels. This is me speaking here. Continuously breaking the mores and the cultural norms and dictates of the time, like picking grain on the Sabbath. The Pharisees were outraged. Why are you guys picking grain on the Sabbath? You know you're not supposed to do any work on the Sabbath. You're supposed to rest on the Sabbath. And Jesus says, that you may know that I am the Lord of the Sabbath. And then he invokes King David and his followers eating and doing quote-unquote work on the Sabbath day. He says that man was not made for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man. So Jesus completely broke with tradition there and in other situations, for example, keeping company with tax collectors and sinners, prostitutes, and others. That was horrifying to the scribes and Pharisees who tried to discredit Jesus for doing these things. But time and time again, Jesus not only shows that he wasn't bound by or beholden to the dictates and mores of his day, he freely broke them all the time because he had something better in mind. So that's what John Paul II is referring to here, that it did not proceed from sociological or cultural motives peculiar to his time. Continuing, and I'm almost, it's more than half over now. So John Paul II says, in my letter, Ab Mulieris Dignitatem, which means on the dignity of women, I myself wrote in this regard, in calling only men as his apostles, Christ acted in completely free and a sovereign manner. In doing so, he exercised the same freedom with which, in all his behavior, he emphasized the dignity and the vocation of women without conforming to the prevailing customs and to the traditions sanctioned by the legislation of his time. In fact, the Gospels and Acts of the Apostles attest that this call was made in accordance with God's eternal plan. Christ chose those whom he willed, and he gives Bible verses that kind of reference each of these statements. And he did so in union with the Father through the Holy Spirit. After having spent the night in prayer, therefore, in granting admission to the ministerial priesthood, the Church has always acknowledged as a perennial norm her Lord's way of acting and choosing the 12 men whom he made the foundation of his Church. These men did not, in fact, receive only a function which could thereafter be exercised by any member of the Church. Rather, they were specifically and intimately associated in the mission of the Incarnate Word himself. The apostles did the same when they chose fellow workers who would succeed them in their ministry. Also included in this choice were those who, throughout the time of the Church, would carry on the apostles' mission of representing the Lord and Redeemer. Furthermore, the Pope says, the fact that the Blessed Virgin Mary, Mother of God and Mother of the Church, received neither the mission proper to the apostles nor the ministerial priesthood shows that the non-admission of women to priestly ordination cannot mean that women are of lesser dignity, nor can it be construed as discrimination against them. Rather, it is to be seen as the faithful observance to a plan to be ascribed to the wisdom of the Lord of the universe. The presence of the role of women in the life and mission of the Church, although not linked to the ministerial priesthood, remain absolutely necessary and irreplaceable. As the Declaration Inter Insigniores points out, the Church desires that Christian women should become fully aware of the greatness of their mission. Today, the role is of capital importance, both for the renewal of humanization of society and for the rediscovery by believers of the true face of the Church. Now, he's almost done. There's only like three more short paragraphs, and here's what he says. The New Testament and the whole history of the Church give ample evidence of the presence in the Church of women, true disciples, witnesses to Christ in the family and in society, as well as in total consecration to the service of God and of the gospel. By defending the dignity of women and their vocation, the Church has shown honor and gratitude for those women who, faithful to the gospel, have shared in every age in the apostolic mission of the whole people of God. They are the holy martyrs, virgins, and mothers of families, who bravely bore witness to their faith and passed on the Church's faith and tradition by bringing up their children in the spirit of the gospel. Moreover, he says, it is to the holiness of the faithful that the hierarchical structure of the Church is totally ordered. For this reason, the Declaration Inter Insigniores recalls, the only better gift which can and must be desired is love. quoting St. Paul in 1 Corinthians 12 and 13. The greatest in the kingdom of heaven are not the ministers, but the saints. Although the teaching that priestly ordination is to be reserved to men alone has been preserved by the constant and universal tradition of the church and firmly taught by the magisterium in its more recent documents, at the present time, in some places, it is like Germany, by the way, that's me speaking, at the present time and in some places, it is nonetheless considered still open to debate. Or the church's judgment that women are not to be admitted to ordination is considered to have a merely disciplinary force. Wherefore, here's the money quote, ready? Wherefore, in order that all doubt may be removed regarding a matter of great importance, a matter which pertains to the church's divine constitution itself, in virtue of my ministry of confirming the brethren, thereby he's invoking what Jesus said to Peter in Luke 22, 32, I declare, he says, that the church has no authority whatsoever to confer priestly ordination on women, and that this judgment is to be definitively held by all the church's faithful. So that was signed by him in 1994. So there you have the authoritative magisterial proclamation of why. But some people, over against what he himself said, they continue to yammer on about how, well, yeah, but we want to have women in the priesthood. So that's, I would say, the foundation that we should pay attention to. And he gives this outline. You know, Jesus did this with forethought. Jesus did this in a particular way, not because he was ruled by the customs. He wasn't. Not because he thought it was expedient to only have men. He didn't. But because this is part of his plan for the church. And the church doesn't have the authority to change what Jesus has set down. The point about Mary, keep in mind that the Catholic Church is the one who points out that the greatest human person in all of history is a woman. Jesus was not a human person. He was a divine person with the divine and human nature. But Mary, a creature, is a human person. And she is par excellence the best human being ever, a woman. And she was not given the priesthood. So that's an important point to ponder. And then lastly, I will add something that Pope John Paul II himself doesn't discuss in this document, but I think it's worthy of discussion, is that you see in Scripture, not only in the Gospels, but maybe even more pointedly in the writings of St. Paul, that the priest is the... And let's look at what St. Paul has to say about Jesus. Jesus is the bride of Christ. I'm sorry, Jesus is the bridegroom, and the church is the bride of Christ. And at Mass, think about this for a minute. At Mass, the priest who is acting in the Latin phrase that's used is in persona Christi. It's just a Latin phrase that means in the person of Christ. And the priest at the altar is speaking the words of Jesus to his bride, the church. And there is a nuptial dimension to this, a marital dimension to this. It's not sexual, it's not erotic, but there is a nuptial meaning here that we see when the priest is saying, this is my body, which is given up for you. This is my blood, the cup of my blood, which will be poured out for you and for many. What you see here is this nuptial language of the bridegroom totally giving himself to his bride, and the bride, the church, totally giving herself to the bridegroom, to the husband. So one of the realities that would cause tremendous distortion and would mar, to put it lightly, our understanding of what's happening here would be if a woman were standing at the altar in the place of the bridegroom, who is by definition a male, speaking these words of nuptial love to another woman, aka the church, the bride of Christ. So even at that level, we can see that disruption and distortion begin immediately to change the meaning, or I would say to subvert the meaning, of that relationship between the bridegroom and the bride, between Christ and the church. So there are deep theological reasons that we can discern in Christ's reasons for choosing only men. And I realize that some people don't like it, fair enough, But that's what Jesus himself did. So the church rightly says that the church does not have the authority or the power to change something that Jesus established permanently. Now, I realize that's a long answer to a short question, but it's an important question, and it deserves as much answer as there's time for. So I'll pause there, Colby. Any thoughts on that? Any reactions to it?
You've answered it perfectly. I'll probably have her listen to exactly what you said.
Okay. Well, forgive the long-windedness, but it was an important question that deserved more rather than less. So I'm glad I can help on that. And there was one really good article that was written by, what was her name? She taught theology down at, I think, the University of St. Thomas in Houston. What was her name? Little was her last name. Diana Little, or I forget her. I'll have to look it up. But she, I don't believe she's teaching anymore. She may be retired. But she wrote a really well done, like a 10-page article explaining in much greater detail. Joyce Little, that was her name. Dr. Joyce Little. I'm going to have to search for that, see if I can find it online. I hope it's online. It was a really good article by Dr. Joyce Little explaining in deeper fashion the reasons why the holy orders are reserved to men alone. So I'm going to try to find that, Colby, and if I do, I'll announce it on the show. So that'd be another resource that you can look for. All right, let's take a break. We'll come back with more of the Patrick Madrid Show. We have not a whole lot more, but we've got more. And you can be part of it when you call this number, 888-914-9149. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester, an Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
All right, Lunger. Let's do it.
Hey, I'm smiling at how big you're smiling. All I have to do is play that, and you're beaming.
It's all it takes. I'm like a child with a new toy, but it's not a new toy.
I love it. Tombstone, check it out. Patrick's favorite. I do have a question here. Someone had just called in and asked us. They reminded us yesterday at the end of the show. You said you were going to mention a Reiki book.
Yeah. I did say that, didn't I? The book is by Brother Max Scully, S-C-U-L-L-Y. He's an Australian. And the book is called Yoga, Tai Chi, and Reiki, A Guide for Christians. So it deals with those three topics. And it's very interesting. So people say, well, I've heard that Reiki's bad. Well, why is it bad? Well, I'm not a Reiki expert, never have been, but I've read enough on it to know that there's some serious incompatibilities with Christianity. But he, in this book, does a really good job of kind of systematically debunking and showing why Reiki is not something that Christians should be involved in. So I refer you to that book, Yoga, Tai Chi, and Reiki by Max Scully.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy to. By the way, I found that article. I thought I was going to have a hard time finding it, but this is an article by Dr. Joyce Little that I had read back in the day. She wrote this in, I think it was like 1985. She was a professor of theology. I don't know. I kind of lost track of what became of her. So I think she was teaching theology at that time, or at the very least, she was in academia at that time. But anyway, so her name is Dr. Joyce Little. And the article is called Women in Ordination, and it's really good. It blew my mind when I read it the first time around back in the 80s, and I kind of lost track of my my photocopied copy. So I'm really glad that I found it. It didn't take me much effort to find it, but it's at your fingertips now. If you want this article, if you want to really understand at a deeper level why the Catholic Church does not ordain women to the priesthood, it has nothing to do with women being inferior or any of that claptrap. The church does not teach that, and that's not what it means. But this article will help a great deal. So go to the show Twitter feed, at P Madrid Show, and you'll see it there. Click it, and we want to say courtesy of Christendom College, our great friends at Christendom College, love those guys, and they have it posted on their website. So you can get it in PDF form if you wish, or you can read it in the version that's on their website. But that's where you'll find it, the at P Madrid Show Twitter feed. Now, for those of you who, for whatever reason, are allergic to Twitter, just go to the show page, and that's relevantradio.com/Patrick. And in the right-hand side there, you'll see the Twitter feed, and you'll see the link there. You can click it from there as well. Tole et lege. Let's go now to Ben in Bryan, Texas. Good morning, Ben.
Morning. Thanks for taking my call. My question is about the way the Mass is celebrated. Okay. Cardinal Ratzinger, in his book, The Spirit of the Liturgy, talks about how Vatican II never intended to have the priest face the people when saying Mass. Right. He talks about how the Mass is about everybody facing God together. And so if he's right about that, he was at Vatican II, and he's bearing true witness to the essence of the liturgy. Is it reasonable for faithful Catholics to expect their local Novus Ordo Mass to be celebrated ad orientem?
Well, that's a good question. No, it's not reasonable for them to expect that it would be celebrated ad orientem, because virtually no priests celebrate it that way. Now, that's a matter of actual fact as opposed to how I would like it to be. I think, and I do agree with Cardinal Ratzinger, I think that he was right on target that the preferred way is for the priest and the people to face the Lord together. And so I think ad orientem is the proper way to go. But of course, I have no say in the matter. I can only agree with those who did have a say, like when he was Pope. I certainly agreed with him. I'm not trying to be coy here, but what I'm saying is it reasonable for them to expect their local Catholic Church to do that? No, it's not reasonable, because it's not going to happen. Because the attitude, generally speaking, would be that that's retrograde, that's, you know, overly traditional, that's a rejection of Vatican II. And as you correctly point out, Ben, Sacrosanctum Concilium doesn't say that the priest must face, versus populum, you know, the Latin phrase that's used, the priest facing the people. It doesn't say that, doesn't mandate that. So it's an odd thing where there's this sort of resistance to the idea of the priest and the people facing God together. Because it has become so ingrained that the priest would face the people that it's kind of unthinkable for many priests. They just would never consider doing it. So it's in that sense that I mean that it's unreasonable. I think the ideal is good, but I don't think people should expect that they'll see that very commonly.
I see. That makes sense. I just wonder what sort of obligation a priest has before God to celebrate Mass the way Cardinal Ratzinger understood it to be celebrated, kind of analogously like with enforcing Canon 916 about not giving communion to, you know, manifest grave sinners, baby mm-hmm. killers. Cardinal Burke says, I was looking at his document the other day, he says it's a misunderstanding to think that Canon 916 is a penalty that's only enforced by the bishop. According to Cardinal Burke, it should be enforced or applied by any minister of Holy Communion, including priests. And it seems like that analogously can be applied to the Mass. Like, why is the priest waiting for the bishop to tell him to celebrate Mass properly if he has a direct obligation before God to celebrate it properly?
Well, he doesn't have a direct obligation before God to celebrate the Mass ad orientem. That's a correction we have to make right here. The Church does not say, nor has it said, since the time of the Council, that you must say the Mass one way or the other. The custom became to celebrate the Mass facing the people. We're talking about the priest here. That became the custom, and it's actually encoded in you'll see it in the general instruction of the Roman Missal, where it says that the priest faces the people. I'd have to go back and double check the language on that. But it has reached the point now where it is assumed that that will be the way in which the priest will celebrate Mass. But unless the bishop of the diocese specifically says or specifically forbids Mass ad orientem, the priest has the discretion to celebrate Mass ad orientem or facing the people. So he's not mandated. I mean, I shouldn't say that. In some dioceses, unfortunately, there is a mandate along those lines that you can't celebrate the Mass ad orientem. But that's not very widespread, thankfully. So that's, I think, the fly in the ointment here, is that the priest is not, under pain of sin, obliged to celebrate Mass in one direction or the other. But he has the discretion to do so if he chooses.
Okay, that's encouraging to hear. It just seems like it would be better objectively if the priest did celebrate Mass ad orientem, keeping in harmony with what the Mass is and what it's supposed to do for us.
Yeah, but remember one thing too, that I grant you that the aesthetics are more pleasing and the theology is more profoundly expressed in things like that, where we face the East together. That's what ad orientem means, for those who aren't familiar with the term. It's just Latin, means toward the East. There is richness and beauty, all of the above. I don't deny that. I affirm that. But that does not go to the essence of the validity of the Mass, or the laicity of the Mass, for that matter. So for the Mass to be valid, it does not depend in any way upon which direction the priest is facing. We can appreciate and prefer one versus the other, but it doesn't touch upon the essence of the Mass itself or its validity. And that's important to keep in mind. Otherwise, it could become a distortion for people to think, unless the priest is facing East, there's a problem with this Mass. And that's not true. Jesus, when he celebrated Mass at the Last Supper in the upper room, we don't know which direction he was facing. But the first Mass certainly did not have the external accoutrements and trappings of the traditional Latin Mass. It didn't have any of those things. And yet it was the Mass, the very first Mass celebrated by Jesus. So I think we have to keep those things clear in mind so we don't wind up overemphasizing something that doesn't rise to that level. You know what I mean, Ben?
I guess that's fair. It just seems like there's something off about the emphasis on validity and laicity and taste and personal preference, which I don't negate. I don't say anything you said is false. It just seems there's something really wrong and really off about the way Mass is celebrated currently, just like there's something really wrong and really off about people like Joseph Biden continuing to receive.
Hey, you know what, Ben? You're coming across to me now as a bomb thrower, kind of like your Trojan horse is, let's talk about the Mass, but now you're throwing bombs in other different directions. So why don't we just stick to this one topic rather than branch out into these other things? So if your concern is the Mass and ad orientem, I get it. I understand that. I prefer ad orientem myself. But the current climate in the church right now is not, the wind is not blowing in that direction, let's just say. And I have a feeling that in due time, eventually, it will begin going back in that other direction. These things happen. So I think the best thing that you and I can do is love Jesus, be loyal to the church, say our prayers, and press on. You know, there's no point in, I don't see how it serves you or anyone else to become over anxious about it. We have to deal with it the way it is and do the best we can. That's my advice.
But we're all baptized, and meaning we're all prophets, and it's not bomb throwing to say what we're seeing here in multiple places is a lack of respect for the Eucharist and the way God is to be worshiped.
I agree, but I'm not referring to that. What I mean is that you called in and you started talking about ad orientem Mass. Then the next thing I know is then you go in a different direction, you know, on a separate topic. Now it's Joe Biden. And I would rather focus on the topic that you had brought up originally. I mean, we could talk about those other topics, but it suggests that maybe you want to. That's why I said bomb throw, because there are a lot of other targets you seem to be aiming against now. Anyway, Ben, thank you. I appreciate our conversation. I hope we talk again. I have to press on, though. Let's go to Joseph now in Mount Laurel, New Jersey. Good morning, Joseph.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you. So I wonder if you could help me understand during the Mass when the intercessory prayer goes into remember our brothers and sisters who have died in the hope of the resurrection and those who have died in your mercy. Forgive me, I'm paraphrasing.
You're doing rather well. You have it down.
What are they referencing there? It seems to be two-phased. Those who have died in your mercy and those brothers and sisters who have died in the hope of the resurrection. Is that purgatory they're referencing? I don't understand it.
Yeah, well, any prayers for the dead are, by definition, prayers for the souls in purgatory because, as you already know, if the soul is in hell, prayers can't help, and if the soul is in heaven, prayers are not necessary. So by definition, any time at Mass or in any other context, you hear prayers for those who have died, that's specifically for the souls in purgatory. So
gotcha.
Without, you know, I don't have the text in front of me, so I can't like really closely look at it, but I'm going to say off the top of my head that it is one of two things. It's either in a subtle way, just referring to people who we are asking the Lord to have mercy on who may not have been baptized or who may have been baptized but are not members of the Catholic Church. And then the other category would be those who are deceased Catholics. That's one possibility. I'd have to study it. The other possibility is it's just a reinforcement of the same thing. In other words, we're praying for these folks who are in purgatory. And it's not, I don't want to say redundant, but it's sort of more emphasis, but it's saying the same thing about the same group of people. I think it's got to be one or the other.
I was leaning in that direction, but I haven't had that kind of clarity from anyone. It's been years since I try to understand the Mass and pay attention deeply, and that's just been going over my head for years. So I appreciate the clarity.
Oh, well, I'm happy to help, and there are people who have much more to say on the topic than I just did, but I'm glad that was helpful.
Very much so. Thank you, Patrick.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate that. Let's go to Ernest now in New York. New York, New York. Welcome, Ernest.
Good morning, Patrick. Yes, I was listening to the caller who commented on Ad Orientum.
Yes.
And how you'd make Vatican II had never mandated that the priest face the people. Vatican II also mandate communion in the hand.
Right.
And these things came all the sixth. In my opinion, they weakened a religion, but more seriously, they weakened a faith where a lot of people have lost reverence for the Blessed Sacrament. And Mass is more of a social thing. I see people giving the sign of peace and waving to each other while the Agnus Dei is starting to be said. So that's all I have to say, Patrick. I'm not a fan of Paul the Sixth.
Can I offer just a little footnote to what you said? Because I remember, I don't know how old you are, but I vividly, vividly remember what the Mass was like in the late 60s, throughout the 70s and beyond. And I never saw, that I recall anyway, I never saw communion in the hand until, and I never really noticed it until late 70s or early 80s. My understanding of this, Ernest, is that it wasn't Pope Paul VI who granted permission for communion in the hand. Rather, that it was being done more and more and more and more, and it was considered a liturgical abuse. And it was actually, I don't know if condemned is the right word for it, but it was disapproved even from the Congregation for the Sacraments and Divine Worship. And it wasn't until John Paul II was when he was the Pope, and he, although he resisted it and disapproved of it and would not distribute Holy Communion in the hand, eventually, I think he buckled under the force of this because it was just continuing and building and building, and eventually he's like, ugh, all right, well, you know, and so he permitted it by way of concession. I don't think it was Paul VI who did that. I think it was John Paul II. I'd have to check the records, but I'm pretty sure I'm accurate on this one.
I thought it was Paul VI in 1969, but I could be wrong because then in the late 60s, early 70s, it was a transition period. So, but that's, I mean, I think that these things, you know, you give people an inch psychologically and they take a yard. And, you know, it just seems that reverence for the Mass and reverence for the whole Blessed Sacrament is diminished.
I think that's true. And I know that there have been some sociological surveys done by CARA, for example. It's an acronym for a Catholic, it's kind of like a Pew Research type organization, but it's Catholic run. And it has produced some studies that show a precipitous decline in belief in the real presence and reverence for the Eucharist. And I think there are a number of different root causes for that, this perhaps being one of them. In my view, I know some people strongly disagree with me. I personally think that receiving Holy Communion on the tongue is more reverent than receiving it in the hand. I realize some people get irked when I say that, but I really do believe that. And I'm in the minority. You and I are in the minority, Ernest. Most Catholics don't agree with us.
It creates a casualness towards the Blessed Sacrament. And, you know, without the real presence, without the Blessed Sacrament, we wouldn't even have a Mass. It would just be a Protestant happy hour.
Well, that's true. Let's not be mean. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. I do. I really do. And I deplore the fact that so many people have lost their sense of the sacred. They've lost their realization of Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. I mean, take for example, I had a call just recently from a gentleman, you might have heard it, a really nice guy, I really enjoyed talking to him, but he left the Catholic Church and he's now a Protestant. And although he didn't say the words exactly this way, what he was saying is he didn't feel like he was being fed in the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. So he went where he thought he could be fed. Now, when I hear that from a former Catholic, I immediately think to myself, what did you think you were receiving when you went to Holy Communion as a Catholic? I mean, that is Christ himself under the appearance of bread and wine. So I can't help but think that many people who walked away or faded away or drifted away, they did so because they never really knew that this is Jesus in the Holy Eucharist. And if you don't know that, then why would you be drawn to that if it's just a piece of bread as far as you're concerned? So I'm validating the point you're making. I'm affirming the point that you're making, but I don't want to be doom and gloom about it. Yes, it's a real problem, and the bishops have instituted this Eucharistic revival in this country, and I'm so happy to see that. It's a systematic effort to help people regain their sense of the sacred, help Catholics regain their sense of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. We should rejoice about that for sure, and let's pray that it has the desired effect, that what you and I see as a problem now will become a lot less of a problem going forward.
I mean, even things like dress, Patrick, you know, the way people go to church too casually, it just diminishes the importance. People put on a suit and tie if they were having dinner at the White House. Why can't they dress to have dinner in God's house?
Well, we can rejoice that they're going at all. I mean, the fact that they're there at Mass is something to be happy about. And I guess one foot after the other. We'll take one step at a time. And who knows where things will go, but I'm with you. We need to do more. I mean, by our own personal example, if nothing else. Thank you. I'll be right back. Looking for a new job? How about one that offers you opportunities for spiritual, social, and charitable growth? Our sponsor, the Catholic Order of Foresters, is hiring new agents today. Visit relevantradio.com/forester. An Illinois life insurance company not available in all states.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
Hey, real quick, here's an email that came in on topic, by the way. This is from Mark listening in Dallas. Thank you, Mark. He says, hello, Patrick. I've seen the meme with the school bus driver either facing the windshield or facing the passengers, and the meme says, which bus driver do you want? I understand this, and I prefer Ad Orientem, even though I've never been to a new order of the Mass with the priest Ad Orientem. But given the priest is in persona Christi during the consecration, would it be more proper for the consecration to be celebrated with the priest facing the congregation? Thanks for your great show. Well, thank you, Mark. Yeah, I mean, you know, we're human beings. So for you to see the priest has some advantages. I mean, if he's facing towards you and you're facing toward him, there is a certain advantage because you can see more clearly what's taking place on the altar. This, by the way, is why the bells were rung. So in the traditional Mass, and even now in the new rite of the Mass, the bells were rung so that you would know what's happening on the altar. Because if the congregation and the priest are facing ad orientem, and when the priest, and of course during the low Mass, in the traditional Mass, you wouldn't even hear what the priest was saying. You would know when the bells rang, when the epiclesis, sometimes called the epiclesis, when the priest would extend his hands down and begin the sacramental action of transubstantiation. You would know because they would ring the bells. You would know by him elevating the host. This, by the way, was introduced, it seems, around the 11th or 12th century in Paris, I think is where it first started, as I recall. I wasn't there at the time, but done some study on it. And the reason that this became so widespread was because it was another way for the people to know, okay, Jesus is now present on the altar. When the priest raises the host up, the elevation, they didn't do that in the early church. And that was a good custom because then people could know even more. And when they would hear the altar boys, the acolytes, saying like the Suscipiat, for example, the prayer that they would say, they were speaking on behalf of the congregation. So these are the ways in which the congregation could know where they were in the Mass. So just as a practical matter, I can understand, and I readily would say that there is an advantage for you to see and know more clearly what's happening. I don't deny that. But remember, too, that at the Last Supper, Jesus was not consecrating the Eucharist at the first Mass for a congregation of lay people. The people who were there in the room with him were the apostles, the disciples who happened to be the apostles, who were being ordained to the priesthood. As the Council of Trent pointed out, that it was at the Last Supper where they were being ordained to the priesthood. So what that means is that the way Jesus said, for example, take and eat, and he handed them, these are things that would be proper for priests that are in a different category for lay people. So as we consider the Last Supper, we have to take that into account. You asked some great questions, Mark, and I'm glad you did. Thanks for the email. Back to the phones. Let's go now to Kathy in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I just have a question and wanted your opinion on the cause for sainthood for Dorothy Day. Mm-hmm. And one of my, the reason I ask is that they talk about the Catholic worker movement, and sometimes I see articles that seem to suggest that a left agenda, like with abortion and LGBT rights. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering what your opinion was on that.
Yes. Well, first I'll begin with just a personal note on my part, and that is that I have never personally been drawn in any way toward Dorothy Day, having read some things by her and some things about her. She's not somebody who I find I'm drawn toward. And there are aspects of her history that, of course, you know, in some ways they track nicely with other saints who lived lives of great sin before they had their conversion. And she certainly did. But she had a conversion and she became a serious Catholic and she was dedicated to serving the poor and such, which I can greatly admire. Seems that one of the things that has happened since her time was that her legacy, I think, was, I don't want to say hijacked, that's probably the wrong word, but her legacy was, it was latched onto, let's say, by some in the radical left with socialist, communist leanings and kind of a radical and exaggerated approach to the topic. And she became, rightly or wrongly, I think, associated in the minds of many people with that kind of leftist ideology. And it may well be that she would have repudiated some of what has been done in her name in any case. I mean, the Catholic Worker, somebody, I think as a prank, years ago, they subscribed me to the Catholic Worker newspaper, and I would read it, you know, and kind of browse through it and see, and it just struck me as kind of like a, a sanctified communist newspaper. I mean, it's not that, but it kind of came across that way. So my opinion probably doesn't really amount to anything on the topic because I don't really have enough interest in her, I guess. I hope she's in heaven. I mean, she may well be in heaven. So nothing negative to say about her per se, but I'm just not drawn toward it. So I don't have a lot to go on. I know some people who do tend to be leftist Catholics politically, or they consider themselves quote unquote progressives. I think that's a misnomer in any case. It seems a very common thing that they tend to be really, really, really into Dorothy Day. So I don't know if that means anything, but I don't really have an opinion one way or the other. If the church in her wisdom determines that Dorothy Day is a saint in heaven, then I'll rejoice along with everyone else. I mean, why not rejoice that she's in heaven? And if miracles take place as a result of her intercession, I will rejoice. And I guess I'll just take a wait-and-see approach to it. I don't really have any strong feeling one way or the other.
So. No, I appreciate that. That helps. And I work with students. They talk about saints and talk about this. So I just kind of wanted another opinion on it.
Yeah. I would say she would be similar in a way to St. Oscar Romero, who also is a real, very, very popular, tends to be very, very popular with Catholics who are theologically and politically left of center. And I don't know what that means exactly, but it's something that I've taken notice, and I think that the issue with Dorothy Day seems to be a similar phenomenon. But we'll see. If she's in heaven, then let's rejoice, and let's ask her to pray for us. We'll find out in due time. Thank you. Let's go now to Mia in Temecula, California, wine country. Good morning, Mia.
Good morning. My question was, I've never been to a traditional Latin Mass. I was wondering if they kneel during the Agnus Dei, and if it's appropriate to kneel at the Novus Ordo, because some people do and some people don't. Just wondering what they do at the traditional Latin Mass.
Yes, you do kneel during the Agnus Dei. And the in the new Mass, the custom is to stand, and when the Agnus Dei is recited by the people, then you kneel. And I have noticed that, Mia. I've noticed in the new Mass where some people, they kneel. Everyone else is standing, but they kneel before that. And I suspect in some cases it's because typically that's when the tabernacle is opened and the consecrated hosts are removed from the tabernacle. And I think some people have this misguided sense that, well, they better kneel because the tabernacle is being opened, which is a good thing to do unto itself. But they seem to forget that Christ is already present on the altar, and they were standing just before that with Christ present on the altar. He doesn't become more present on the altar when the tabernacle door is opened. But that's a harmless thing, and it's always good to show more reverence than less. But in this case, I would say it's not helpful. It's not desirable for people on their own to kneel when everyone else is standing, because it introduces a note of disunity, unintentionally, I'm sure. But, you know, when I'm at the traditional Latin Mass, I kneel when everybody kneels. I don't stand in some parts of the Mass because that's how they do it in the new Mass. I do it the way the traditional Mass calls for it. And the same should be true in reverse, if you ask me. So rather than insisting on, well, in the traditional Mass, this is where we kneel, so we're going to kneel, I don't think that's the right spirit, personally. I think we should be unified in our postures. Now, one distinction maybe would be there are some places in the country, thankfully not too many of them, but there are a few where a long time ago, the bishops told the people that during the Eucharistic prayer and after the Eucharistic prayer and after communion that you must stand, which I think was a very pastorally unwise decision back in those days. And some of the bad fruits that have come from that pastorally unwise decision are manifest. And one of the things that is strange is when Catholics from different parts of the country where kneeling is the custom during that time, and everybody kneels, and you've got one or two or three or four Catholics who refuse to kneel, and they insist on standing because that's what they were told they're supposed to do. That is another example of where it introduces disunity and a strangeness into a time of the Mass where we should all be united. So I know what you're saying, and that would be my prescription, would be when it's time to kneel, kneel. When it's time to stand, stand. And if the whole church in the United States has the custom of kneeling during the Eucharistic prayer, let's all kneel. That's my thought. Thank you. I think we have time for Heidi in Milwaukee. Good morning, Heidi.
Morning, Patrick. Yeah, quick question. I received my first communion in the late 70s, and at the time I thought I learned that it was fine to take normally on the tongue or in the hand. Yeah. But the real question I have is I remember being told that you don't chew the host. You either swallow it or you let it dissolve on your tongue.
I remember the same thing. No, I think that's it's a kind of a beautiful, pious thought, a beautiful, pious notion. I remember the nuns telling us the very same thing in the 60s. Don't chew the host. And the thought behind it, I think, was that somehow you're going to hurt Jesus, and you can't hurt Jesus. He's glorified and resurrected. So I was told the very same thing. But as I grew older, I realized that was just sort of a pious notion. And you can chew the host if you wish. I think it's easy for it to dissolve on your tongue. It doesn't take long. But if you were to chew the host, you're not committing a sin or doing anything wrong. And you're certainly not hurting Jesus. That's for sure.
Okay, good to know, because I usually find it sticking to the roof of my mouth and then I'm using my tongue to pray it off. And that just doesn't seem
been there, done that. Really, I know what you mean. I know. Well, Jesus loves you, and he's happy that you've received Holy Communion. That's for sure.
Hey, thanks for covering this topic. It's really interesting.
My pleasure. Thanks for calling, Heidi. I don't have time for another call, but I do have time to mention one other thing. For some strange reason, there are some people who tell you that you shouldn't make the sign of the cross after you receive Holy Communion. I have no idea where that came from, but that's not something you should pay any attention to. If you make the sign of the cross to bless yourself after you make your first Holy Communion, that's fine. If you don't do it, that's fine too. But don't let anyone tell you that you shouldn't do it, because that's not true. Until tomorrow, I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.